Les colloques du Collège de France.
J'ai l'honneur d'introduire donc cette séance. Je vais immédiatement donc présenter notre prochain intervenant. Il s'agit donc de Nicolas Sinai, professeur d'islamologie à l'Université d'Oxford. C'est un immense connaisseur du texte coranique, j'insiste, avec une bibliographie extrêmement prolifique. Je ne citerai que un de ses derniers ouvrages, The Quran, an Historical Critical Introduction, et aussi très prochainement, je crois qu'au mois de juin, nous aurons a dictionary, an historical critical dictionary of the Quran.
Key terms of the Quran.
Ah, key terms of the Quran. Excusez-moi. Voilà. Et donc, votre intervention s'intitule Quranic Chronology and its Limits. Et vous avez immédiatement la parole. Et encore une fois, merci de votre présence parmi nous.
Merci pour cette introduction. Je suis ravi d'être ici. Merci pour l'invitation. Je dois aussi remercier le Conseil européen de la recherche pour soutenir mon travail sur le Coran. Et maintenant, je vais parler en anglais, because it's much easier. I'm a bard. When I first started publishing, 12 years ago, one of my first pieces was a very kind of spirited attempt to defend Quranic chronology, which I'll talk about in a moment. And I had a little spat with what is now actually a dear friend of mine, Gabriel Reynolds, because we ended up on opposite sides of that debate. I think we've both calmed down a bit about it, but it's certainly an interesting opportunity to sort of, it was for me preparing this talk, to think about how much of that maybe slightly exuberant, youthful enthusiasm I still share, and to some degree I still do. So Quranic chronology, which figures in the title, is really a kind of shorthand for scholarly hypotheses about the relative temporal order of Quranic texts. So can we say whether bits of the Quran come before or after other bits? And can we maybe expand that into a system of classification that gives us the relative temporal position of any part of the Quran with regard to others. This issue of the relative dating of the Quran, so the unfolding of Quranic discourse in history, if you will, is, I think, separate from that of the Quran's absolute date. So the relationship of the Quran to extra-Quranic events like the death of Muhammad, for instance, the early conquests. But the two topics have been linked traditionally. And that's certainly a legacy of pre-modern Muslim scholarship. As you know, pre-modern Muslim scholars approach the Quran as a corpus of revelations that was revealed during the lifetime of Muhammad. So there's very much a historicizing, contextualist approach to the Quran at work there. And that manifests itself on the one hand in narratives that are called Asbab al-Nuzul, narratives about the occasions of revelation of particular Quranic passages. But the same approach, I think the same underlying approach, also manifests itself in enumerations, in lists of Meccan and Medinan surahs. And some of these lists, implicitly or explicitly, do not just subdivide the Quran into Meccan and Medinan texts, but also give an order of these surahs, or at least of their opening passages. There's now an excellent doctoral dissertation by Emmanuel Stefanidis, who has really written what I think is probably at the time being the definitive history of Quranic chronologies. So she starts by looking at the earliest attestations of such chronological lists, and they seem to have emerged around the turn of the first and second Islamic centuries in Khorasan. They then get transmitted in some of the classic works of Islamic Quran scholarship. But what Emmanuel observes, I think, fascinatingly, is that a lot of the Islamic authors who transmit these lists do seem to be slightly reticent about them. And they don't actually get used a lot in tafsir as such. And she speculates, I think that's convincing, that that might be due to the fact that maybe these lists could be seen to undermine the adequacy of the canonical surah order of the Quran. And maybe also these lists could be seen to sort of be at odds with the traditional assumption that the Quran was revealed in very short fragments of kind of 5 to 10 verses. So there's reasons why these enumerations weren't terribly popular in the pre-modern Islamic tradition. But it's fascinating to then see that one of those lists ends up in the hands of Gustav Weil, who is one of the founding fathers of sort of modern European serious scholarship on the Quran. And he makes that his starting point for an investigation into the Quran's chronology. So something that's really quite a marginal component of the Islamic tradition then becomes almost a research paradigm in 19th and early 20th century Western scholarship. So a curiosity of sorts turns into a paradigm. And I'm just paraphrasing Emmanuel here, but I think it's an interesting sort of study in how a tradition can undergo very striking metamorphosis into something else in a different cultural context. I think it's due to the fact that European interest in the Quran's chronology starts off this kind of list format that alternative, conceivable paradigms of making sense of the Quran's unfolding history weren't pursued. So prima facie, it's not impossible to consider that maybe we could make sense of the Quran along the lines of what biblical scholars call a documentary hypothesis. So the idea that you can take the Pentateuch, for instance, and you analyze it into the different sources or documents that were redacted together. So something like that could, it's a type of theory that could or could not work for the Quran, but that wasn't pursued. And I think that's certainly due to the fact that the list format, in a way, reigned supreme from the beginnings of Western scholarship. Now, the fact that the alternative paradigm isn't pursued doesn't necessarily mean that kind of people took the wrong approach. I personally do think that the approach taken is largely tenable, but it means that this assumption that you can make sense of the Quran as a sort of linear sequence of discursive units, one after the other, reigned supreme from very, very early on. There's some evidence in the Quran itself that I would say, despite my attempts to sort of remain impartial during this part of my presentation, I think there's some evidence in the Quran that does point towards the kind of linear diachronic paradigm. There's one verse in particular which some of you may know where it seems that the Quranic opponents challenge the Quranic messenger and ask him why was this not sent down jumlatan wahidatan, sort of in one fell swoop or in sort of as one unity. And the implication seems to be that Quranic discourse comes in installments, and that actually seems to be a liability in the context of the Quran against which the Quran needs to defend itself. And I think that gives some support to the kind of assumption that we might be able to reconstruct a linear sequence of units of Quranic discourse. The most famous product of European chronological scholarship is certainly the surah chronology that is usually named after Theodor Neldecker, who was translated into Arabic at the capable hands of George Tarma. But to speak simply of the Neldecker chronology is really to underplay the formative impact of Gustav Weil, who was much less of a sort of mainstream figure, a much more colorful character, much less canonical perhaps. But he was certainly the first scholar who proposed that the Meccan surahs could be subdivided into three periods, the infamous early, middle, and late Meccan surahs. And Neldecker then takes that and runs with it. So that's one particular type of chronological theory. There are others. Hartwig Hirschfeld, for instance, who writes in 1902, has a different attempt of making sense of the linear sequence of Quranic texts. There's, of course, the commentary of Richard Bell, which is a very different different attempt of analyzing Quranic chronology. So to come back to Noldike and Weil, so they started off this list that was transmitted via Zarkashi and Diyarbakri, but they did also, I think, very clearly aim to test the information they are given, they find in their Muslim predecessors by drawing on observations of style, terminology, content. So they try to tweak what they find in the Muslim tradition. And that's one, I think, big controversial issue until today, effectively. Is it the case that a Noldike style chronology can succeed in largely basing itself on considerations of style that are internal to the Quran? Or is it the case that the chronologies that we see certainly being used by scholars are essentially dependent on assumptions that draw from or that derive from the Islamic tradition that are based on extra textual traditions about the Quran? And that is very much the case that Gabriel Reynolds put forward in his French article in Arabica some 10 years ago, that this is essentially circular, that you approach the Quran with certain assumptions about Mecca and Medina in mind, and then you allocate passages that talk about Jews or seem to polemicize against the Israelites to the Medina period, but all you've done is basically you've cut the Quran up according to your preconceptions. This isn't really an argument as much as a self-fulfilling prophecy of sorts. So I think the appropriate response to this worry of circularity is to find a way of constructing a relative chronology of the Quran that is maximally independent of extra-Quranic assumptions. I mean, I personally don't doubt the traditional paradigm of the Quran's genesis in Mecca and Medina at the beginning of the 7th century, but I think for theoretical purposes, it would be good to be able to work out a chronology that doesn't take that for granted. I think that that argument has been made most compellingly and impressively in an article by Behnam Sardeghi in 2011, another massive piece, possibly in the same issue in Arabica, which is weird. yes. Took me a while to sort of catch on to that, which is a very sort of sophisticated stylometric study of the Quran with a lot of math involved. So something that certainly in parts transcends my horizon. I think that is a milestone in chronological scholarship. And the basic argument that Behnam, I think, makes quite successfully is that the mean verse length of Quranic passages, so how long a verse in a surah tends to be, displays a relationship of smooth covariance with a host of lexical features. So there seems to be a link between mean verse length and lexicon, and he tests that against three different lists of Quranic lexemes, and he's looking at a lot of them by using computers, of course. So there seems to be a link here. These two features that one would certainly prima facie think of as properly independent seem to co-vary in a way that requires explanation. And there's a phenomenon here that can't just be a coincidence. And what he suggests is that the assumption of a gradual development over time is the best explanation for the phenomenon. So the idea that over the course of the Quran's genesis, both verse length changed and also lexicon changed and perhaps content changed too, or maybe literary features changed too. So I think that's quite a rigorous and sort of epistemologically principled case for an internal chronology of the Quran that is anchored in immanent features of the text. The specific chronology that Behnam looks at in his article is a modified version of the chronology that was worked out by an Iranian academic and politician, Mehdi Bazargan, who died in the 1990s. But it's a chronology that's based on the assumption that mean verse length grew over time, that verses tended to become longer over the course of Muhammad's ministry, which is also kind of the implicit assumption of Weil and Noldike. Even though Weil and Noldike, they don't really look at it quantitatively. I mean, Noldike will say things like, oh, the language becomes dull and prosaic, but what he really means by that is verses get longer. I mean, there's a perfectly neutral and descriptive way of capturing this, that maybe there's a way with some of the needlessly dismissive language that Noldike does use from time to time. So the desideratum, which I'm arguing for, of separating Quranic chronology from the traditional narrative of the life of Muhammad, I mean, for epistemological purposes, not necessarily because I don't believe in the existence of Muhammad, but that desideratum is also illustrated in a very interesting way by recent work that's been done by Tommaso Tessé, who's published an article some 2 years ago in... Journal Asiatique, I think, Qurans in Contexts, So what he argues is that the historical period that sort of is encompassed by a relative chronology of the Quran ought to be viewed as extending well beyond the lifetime of Muhammad. He's clearly operating with the idea that, you know, it was the Umayyads and the Abd al-Malik who put the finishing touches to the corpus. So it's an extended process of scriptural genesis, much longer than just 20 years. But the interesting feature about that article is that nonetheless, despite these very different this very different vision of how the Quran emerged, Tessé also endorses a chronology that effectively takes a group of surahs as the original kernel of the Quran that largely corresponds to the early Meccan surahs of Weil and Noldike. So there seems to be interesting agreement on what the original layer of the Quran is. It's just that there's a difference as to whether the rest of the Quran is then maybe datable to the lifetime of Muhammad or not, but there seems to be agreement as to the original sort of kernel, or if you will, stem cell of Quranic discourse. I mean, Tommaso doesn't really massively belabor this agreement, but I think it's quite striking that the surahs he looks at are basically the early Meccan surahs, although of course Tommaso wouldn't call them early Meccan because, I mean, that's a very sort of traditional term that he would probably balk at. But I think that's actually grounds to be optimistic, right? It seems that whatever your background assumptions about, you know, how the Quran emerged and how Islam got off the ground, it seems that people can nonetheless agree on sort of basic claims about the Quran's relative chronology. Now, maybe some health warnings. How am I for time?
You have 8 minutes.
8 minutes left. Okay, right. I'll just see how far I get.
10 minutes?
No, that's fine. I'm not trying to negotiate here. So Emmanuelle, in her coverage of chronological theories in modern Quran scholarship, I think she pays very interesting, very welcome attention to how chronologies of the Quran effectively construct storylines, construct what she calls a fabula, a narrative. So what you're often given is a package that involves both a certain amount of textual data and a storyline that makes sense of that data, and the two are sort of mutually supportive. So the textual data is presented in a way that already implies the storyline and vice versa. Emmanuelle isn't really in the business of defending one particular chronology of the Quran or another, so she's quite happy to let that stand as a general observation that, you know, historiography is always narrative, and to some degree I think that's true. I mean, we make sense of the past by telling stories about it, so maybe at the most general level that's hard to take issues with. Take care. Good to see you. But I would still add to that we as scholars of the Quran and early Islam, we probably do need to get much better at sort of turning storylines or narratives into hypotheses. And I think Behnam's article is actually a model of how to do that. So rather than just kind of telling stories that sound plausible and that involve a citation of different bits of the Quran at the right junctures, I think it would be much more helpful to be maybe slightly more explicit about defining a certain data set and a certain set of features of that data set, which are to be explained, the explanandum, if you will, and then identifying what the hypothesis is that is meant to make sense of that explanandum, and to then also consider how that hypothesis sort of competes with alternative ones that are maybe equally tenable. I mean, you know, which one's more elegant, which one's more simple. I think there should always be sort of a comparative or competitive aspect to one's treatment in that sense. I think it would also obviously be helpful to address countervailing data. And I think it's also really important to then be honest about where one as a scholar resorts to auxiliary hypotheses that have a very different function from the initial hypothesis. So an auxiliary hypothesis is a proposition that helps fend off objections or reconcile a hypothesis with evidence that is maybe problematic. It doesn't serve to explain the original explanandum. So I think we could probably, and that includes myself, I think maybe one way of responding to Emmanuel's argument, which I guess I'm keen to do in some way, I'm quite impressed, would be to sort of think much more carefully about the epistemology of Quranic chronologies and be much more explicit about the different components that enter into our theorizing, rather than just telling a plausible story and then hoping that the story will sway, because obviously different stories could sway. And maybe that's not a very satisfactory position to be in. Right, so that was my 2 cents on that. Maybe another point to just make here would be that I do think that constructing a relative chronology of the Quran remains an ongoing endeavor. So I don't think we can use the chronology as a sort of a scaffolding of factual certainty. I think, George, you called it as something that's munazzal, right? As if kind of this list of surahs in a particular order is a set of hard facts. No, it's a theory, and we should probably treat it as such. I think that's particularly crucial when it comes to the so-called middle Meccan period of Nuldika. I mean, I'm not sure that can stand. I'm not sure about the boundaries that Nuldika draws between the middle Meccan surahs and the early and the later Meccan ones, on the other hand. So I usually just speak of early Meccan and later Meccan surahs, because I'm really very doubtful about the demarcatability of this intermediate group of surahs. And there might be other respects in which one can sort of improve on and tweak this chronology. So it's a hypothesis subject to further improvement. That also means that I think when we write about a given topic in the Quran, one shouldn't necessarily adopt a default exposition whereby one goes through kind of 4 chronological stages, like, you know, I don't know, anger in the Quran, in the early Meccan surahs, in the middle Meccan, and the later Meccan, and the Medinan surahs. I mean, I think that might be a strategy of exposition that might lend itself to some topics, but I think there will also be other topics that that maybe are appropriately dealt with in a synchronic fashion, where one can just talk about, you know, time in the Quran without necessarily going through different periods. So I think one needs to be open to that, and one shouldn't let the Nuldika chronology sort of tempt one into constantly looking for change and sort of shifts over time. It may just be the case that for a given topic, the Quranic position is largely consistent over time. But I do think that chronological distinctions can be useful. So maybe I want to close with that. I think they can help define more sharply the literary and doctrinal features of the Quran or of different stages of the Quran. So one example, I guess I would still endorse, is the fact that the text that Nuldika, and I suppose also Tommaso, identifies as early Meccan, they lack explicit assertions of monotheism. And that's an observation that Parrot already made in the 1950s. So statements to the effect that inna ilahakum lawahid, your God is only one God, only seem to sort of fade into Quranic discourse around the transition between the early Meccan and the later Meccan surahs. This doesn't seem to have been a doctrinal feature of the earliest Quranic proclamations. Now, that's not to say that the earliest Quranic proclamations are polytheistic, but I think it is relevant to note that explicit assertions of monotheism don't seem to have been sort of on the charismatic agenda of the Quran initially. I mean, I think eschatology is much more prominent. So this theme that there's only one God seems to sort of come in at a slightly later point in time. And then one can, of course, think about why that might be the case. But obviously, that is a chronological observation, and I think that's a tenable one. Another example would be David Marshall's work about the different conceptions of divine punishment in the Meccan and Medinan surahs. I think that largely holds, and that again is obviously predicated on a diachronic distinction between two groups of texts. One reason why, maybe to just finish on another reflection on the epistemology of chronologies, one reason why chronological distinctions allow us to maybe get a more precise sense of what's happening in a given group of surahs is because they underwrite the possibility of looking at part of the Quran without immediately bringing in the rest of the Quran. So if you were to look at the early Meccan surahs that lack explicit assertions of monotheism immediately in combination with the rest of the Quran, then obviously there's enough monotheism elsewhere in the Quran to balance out the fact that you don't get explicit assertions of monotheism in Surah 101 or 85. So that you wouldn't even be able to make the observation that a certain group of texts doesn't have this particular doctrinal feature. So what I guess diachronic distinctions do is they kind of thin out the interpretive data that is immediately relevant. They kind of they constrain the domain of immediately relevant text, and they thereby work against the sort of common denominator interpretation of the Quran, where it's kind of the average across the text as a whole that will emerge as one's interpretation of the text. So so there are limits to Quranic chronology, but I nonetheless do tend to think that it's a feasible endeavor and that it does also have its promises. I think I'll just end here, so any questions would be welcome. Thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.